This is episode 9 of the Sales Change Podcast, and this is the one with Sarah Townsend. Sarah Townsend is someone I met through the You in the Media community. She's got 20 years as a freelance marketing copywriter and copy editor. She helps everyone from ambitious startups to global corporations to use clever copy to get real results from their marketing. Now try saying that twice. On this podcast, we talk about her fantastic book, Survival Skills for Freelancers. Honestly, this book breaks down everything you'd need if you were thinking about starting a business. All the myths, all the worries, all the fears. I highly recommend it. And we also have a chat about mental health and how that affects business leaders. Remember, if you like the podcast, visit www.saleschange.co.uk/podcast. Sign up for the newsletter. Get it in your inbox every Monday morning at 9:45. Enjoy the episode. Hello, Sarah. Welcome to the Sales Change Podcast. How are you?
I'm very good. I've just been for an early morning swim. So that is my best possible way to start the day.
Do you do it in the sea or in the pool?
No, in a pool at the gym.
I do it in the sea. I genuinely go straight into the sea at 6 a.m.
All right, morning. Then. One upmanship already. We're in the pool for 2 minutes. God.
It is absolutely freezing this time of year, but it's so liberating. It's so liberating. And you can't think of anything else when you're in the sea.
No, apart from because survival.
Yeah, exactly that. Exactly that. Which is a nice segue into your book.
How funny. That was
Survival Skills for a Freelancer. Where did the idea come from?
From the fact that I have been freelance for 20 plus years. This is my 21st year. And when I started, there was very little guidance out there on how to run a freelance business. In fact, I didn't really find anything. There were no networking groups. There was no social media to kind of fall back on and get advice from. So I feel like I learned the hard way. I didn't have a mentor or a coach or anything like that. And it took me flipping years to get good at this stuff. Like, I'm talking properly 15 of the 20 years. And I just wanted to share my own experiences and the things that I've learned, the sort of secrets and surprises that I learned through the past 20 odd years, and really just help people to accelerate their own freelance success or small business success or whatever you want to call it, without making as many of the mistakes that I made and without falling down as many of the holes and experiencing as many of the pitfalls as there are out there, because there are a lot of things that can trip you up when you're self-employed.
There are, and your definition of freelancer is just self-employed, isn't it?
It's
running your own business.
Yeah, basically, the reason I use the word freelancer is because that's the community that I operate in. But I consider, though my business is only me, I am still running a business, and it's a really important mindset to adopt, because if you just consider yourself to be just a freelancer, you're not going to get the same level of success as somebody who appreciates that they're running a business and that takes all the steps necessary to do that properly. So yeah, there is a sort of a disclaimer early on in the book about terminology, and not everybody who has benefited from the advice in the book would consider themselves to be a freelancer. They might prefer entrepreneur or coach or consultant or whatever it is. Yeah. It's all the same advice.
How did you fall into your freelancing?
Yeah, well, I did fall into it. It was never part of the career plan. I never kind of saw myself ever being self-employed. But I was working full-time for a magazine publishing agency down in Bristol when I fell pregnant. And I live in Gloucester. I didn't want to go back to work full-time. I didn't think I had it in me to be a full-time mom. And I also need the sort of stimulation of having a career to really achieve that sort of, that's work-life balance in my mind, kind of time with my kids and time with my career. So I wanted a job that I could fit around being a new parent, but my boss at the time was not open to the idea at all. And in fairness, in defense of his attitude, it was 1999. So it was way before the idea of flexible working or remote working. And goodness knows how that business would have coped in the pandemic. I can't imagine. But he basically said, no, sorry, you can't come back part-time. So my direct manager recommended that I went freelance. She took me out for a nice boozy lunch and laid the cards on the table. And it wasn't something I'd ever thought of doing, but I kind of chatted it over with my then husband, and he had a full-time, pretty stable job at the time, which obviously made it financially a lot easier. It took the pressure off. But naturally, I'm somebody who puts a hell of a lot of pressure on myself.
Yeah.
So I never really found it easy. It was kind of bootstrapping it from the word go, and also having that challenge of learning to be a mom and learning to run a business at the same time. So yeah, in a nutshell, that was it.
So my step into freelancing is completely different. So I don't want to make anybody more money than I'm making myself. And that's the position I was getting into. So I'm currently running a valve company, and we turn over £2.2 million a year. But actually, my boss is making more money than I am, but I'm doing all the work. So the idea came from that. Actually, I want to follow my passion. My passion is going into sales teams and helping them and create change and create growth and profit. So why can't I do that on my own terms? So mine was not like an accident. It was planned. And I left school and never thought, I'm going to actually just decide to work for myself. And a lot of people do that. I mean, we had James Sinclair, who's a very successful entrepreneur, on this podcast in season one. And his dream as soon as he left school was to go and work for himself and employ people. Yeah. But it's never been a dream of mine until I started and I had this epiphany that actually I'm making other people more money than I'm making myself. And that shouldn't be right. So it was
a different driver altogether, isn't it?
Yeah. So it wasn't a driver for you straight out of school.
I didn't want to go to uni. So I did start work straight out of school, and I kind of wanted to be part of something bigger than myself. And I had never really, I don't know, I kind of had this ongoing theme that I've never fitted in anywhere really throughout my life. So I think working in my first job, which was for a financial services company, Allied Dunbar, as it was back then, I felt like I was part of something important. And all we were pretty much doing was sending out pensions reminder letters and chasing people up when their direct debits had bounced and that kind of thing. But I actually liked being part of a team. I really enjoyed it. And I learned some incredible skills that way. It sounds like, well, why would you want to start with an admin job? Well, why not? I learned teamwork, total quality management, as was the buzzword back then, how to deal with customers, how to deal with staff, colleagues at all levels. And I became, I think I mentioned this in the book, I became known as their most enthusiastic school leaver. I actually started work on the 8th of the 8th, 88, which is really easy to remember. And I was kind of part of a cohort of about 30 or 40 school leavers. So we all started on the same level. And it kind of always became my goal to just get promoted up a level and up a level quicker than everybody else, because I'm super competitive. I'm actually quite male brained, like in a lot of ways. I always find myself usually being competitive with myself. So that's why I set these. So for example, right now I've got a target, frankly ridiculous, of getting 200 reviews for survival skills before Christmas.
What number are you on?
Oh, well, yesterday I was on 172. Today I'm on 177. So I kind of had a little mini rush of them yesterday, but
you'll be on 178 by the end of the day, Sarah, because I'll review
excellent.
It.
Thank you, Matt. Thank you. But it's so difficult to stay visible on Amazon. There are 32.8 million titles out there. And yes, a hit bestseller in the launch week and in good categories as well, starting a small business, small business sales and marketing. So not those kind of sneaky little, oh yeah, I've been bestseller in cacti and succulents or something like that's completely irrelevant to your own book.
But no one puts that in their bio though, that they just put their top selling author.
Yeah.
Or best-selling author.
Of course, of course. But I mean, at least I have kind of the satisfaction of knowing that I did it properly.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, it's fantastic to be able to say that, but it is so difficult to stay visible. And my driver for writing the book has always been to give back to the freelance community, because it's taken me this long. I've been a single parent for about 12 years, and I now would consider myself to be kind of financially stable. She says, touching wood.
And I which is a good statement to make, really, in the pandemic times.
Huge. And I had just, before the pandemic happened, I had just given myself the whole of January off to write the first draft of the manuscript. I didn't bill a single cent of client work in January. And then the pandemic happened. So, yeah, it has been a funny old year. And I know I was going off on a different tangent back then, but I've completely forgotten what I was saying.
No, it's fine. It's fine. How long did it take you to write the book? Because we had a chat just beforehand, and I'm toying with the idea of writing a book. I'm put off by previous guests who have said it's taken them 2 or 3 years to actually get the nuts and bolts of the book down.
Right. Well, I'm the polar opposite. And there's a reason for that. So first of all, I would say, if you're going to do it, do it. You've got nothing to lose. I never was going to do it. I never thought I had a book in me. In fact, I would actually actively say to people, no, I'm never going to write a book. And it sort of just happened. And it was like, it kind of evolved.
Yeah.
And then it took on a life of its own. And this is what happens with me. I'm very obsessive about things, and I'm hyper driven. And I couldn't think of anything else. When I started working on it, it was all I wanted to be doing. And it just, as I say, it took on a life of its own. So I thought, look, I'm not going to get anything done. I'm not going to be able to do my best client work while I'm completely preoccupied with wanting to get the first draft of this put together. So obviously it's slightly easier for me because I write for a living.
Yeah.
A lot of copywriters I know really struggle to find their own voice, because what we do as kind of our superpower is creating or adopting a voice for our clients. So when we come to write for ourselves, we've often forgotten what we sound like. But because I had kept my hand in with blogging, I used to do a lot of blogging about freelance topics and this sort of thing. I didn't really have that problem. So I knew what my voice was. And I think this is part of what makes the book stand out and why people have related to it so positively, is the fact that it does feel so personal.
Yeah.
They feel that they're being guided on this journey by kind of a trusted friend or a business mentor or whatever. But yeah, going back to the question, doing it again,
that's all right.
I'd say in total about 6 weeks, because 6 weeks to 2 months possibly, but that's because I was doing it 24/7 for a month.
Did you have a premise of what the book was going to be about, or was it just like a flow? So you'd mapped out what you were going to write about?
It changed a hell of a lot during the process, but the thing that gave me the idea of doing the book was that I wrote a blog, and it was called Secrets of Freelance Success. And then it had this subtitle. This was the subtitle for the book. There's another story why this got dropped, but it was actually How to Go Solo Without Going Loco, which I genuinely think completely sums up the premise of the book. That's exactly what it is. But because the book has a mental health slant, and because my foreword is written by Simon Blake, OBE, who is the CEO of Mental Health First Aid England, he's very outspoken about using positive language for mental health issues. And I completely support that. So I dropped the subtitle. But yeah, that blog is still out there somewhere. If anybody wants a taster of the book, there are kind of some of the recurring themes are in that blog. So it just took off, and it got so much positive feedback that I thought, well, maybe I'm onto something. And I can't remember what it was that made me think, do you know what? I'm going to create a book from this popular blog. It just happened.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I work to a specific process which generates results and generates profit and cash and all that sort of stuff in a business. And it's all in my head. And it's like a behavioral set. So it's then trying to map that out. That's probably the bit that I'm most afraid of. The other thing I'm afraid of is, you touched on it there, that you're hyper-driven. I'm hyper-driven. So if I commit to doing a book, I know that I'll commit fully to doing the book. Yeah. And what I don't want to do is to let all of the other stuff, because you see, I'm very active on social media.
Yeah.
I'm very active doing the podcast. There's lots of things that I'm juggling. Mm. And you touch on this in your book. You touch on this about, because you took 15 years to begin outsourcing. Yeah. And I'm already at that stage now where I feel like I should get a VA to help me out. And I've had conversations of two or three. But
finding the right one.
Yeah. What was the catalyst for you to actually do that?
I was just on the verge of burnout, and I just was not pleasant to be around. I've always sort of struggled with stress management, I think, because I am naturally quite an anxious person. I'm quite open about this in the book. I have my own kind of mental health challenges on and off throughout my life. And I really wanted to protect myself and instill some form of balance and boundaries in my life. I've always been absolutely rubbish at boundaries. But it's not necessarily always a bad thing. In my mind, I mean, I'll quite often be replying to people's LinkedIn messages at 10:30 at night, for example, but I don't live with my partner. So there's probably a reason for that. A freaking nightmare. I just want to do this stuff. So I want to reply to people's messages, and I want to be given the book the best possible start in life so that I can reach out and help as many self-employed people as possible. Because I have had emails from people who have said, I've lost my job, haven't been furloughed, your book has given me the confidence to go self-employed. Had a 21-year-old the other day who's gone self-employed on the back of my podcast chat with her. How amazing is that? A 21-year-old doing a podcast. I had a fantastic chat with her. She read a copy of my book and she's now going freelance. And I've had feedback equally from people who've been self-employed for years saying, you know, I knew I could be better at this. I've turned things around. Or even worse, I was applying for jobs. I was going back to employment and I've read your book and now I've completely changed things around. And now I've kind of rediscovered my love for being my own boss. So yeah, again, what is it this morning? I keep losing where I was going. I'm sure I was going somewhere else with that. But yeah, the being driven thing.
We were touching on outsourcing and how you got to the decision.
Outsourcing, yeah. Well, we all know what it's like when you're self-employed. You go self-employed because you have this skill or this passion or this thing that you love doing, and you think that by becoming your own boss, you get to do more of that thing, right? But the reality is so different, and you often get to the end of the week and think, well, hang on, I've spent 40% of my time doing that special thing, and 60% of my time drumming up business, doing proposals, doing admin, invoicing, doing my accounts, fixing my laptop, whatever it is. So it's just a no-brainer to me. I use this equation in the book. As much time as you can doing the thing you love doing that makes you money, as little time as possible doing the things that don't. And that's the secret to freelance success. Because the more time, the more things you can outsource to the people who have those skills, they're time efficient doing those things that would probably take you 5 times longer to do and you do it badly. So actually, the more of those things you can outsource, the more headspace and the more time you free up for yourself to do the thing you love and the thing that makes you money critically.
And that's what when I started outsourcing. So I create videos on the back of the podcast as well. So the Zoom recordings are then put into videos and short, snappy 1 minute clips and sound bites. But I was doing all of that. And you know what? It becomes so long winded because you've got to listen to the podcast. You've then got to slice it up. You've then got to edit it into a sound bite and then put it into a video format. That takes forever. And I found somebody who will do that for me for like 50 quid a podcast, which is like insane value. Oh. So they create 5 or 6 clips for me. Push it away. But the thing I really struggled with, and you touch on in your book, is you go into business to make yourself money. And then I begrudge then giving away that money to somebody else to do you know what I mean? It's that real struggle to give somebody some money to do something that you can do yourself. Yeah, that's what I really struggle with.
That's why it took me so long to start doing it. But it's funny because as soon as I started outsourcing one thing, I thought, well, hang on, I'm getting so much more enjoyment and fulfillment. And I have so much more potential to earn money because all that time that I'm freeing up is time that I can then spend billing clients and doing the work that I love. So it's more fulfilling. You earn more. You don't have to do the things you don't enjoy doing. You don't have to do the things that make you feel bad about yourself because you know that you're not that great at them. And then on the other side of the coin, you've got someone who is a proper expert. So it's almost like you're surrounding yourself with this little success team for your business. You've got kind of a little team of cheerleaders around you who are all supporting your business and empowering you to do the things that make you money.
Yeah.
Because they're doing the things that don't for you. So it is a mindset shift for sure. It is.
And the thing that's really hit me, and I've got no problem now paying people to do the videos and all that type of stuff, is the time I was taking on a Sunday to do the videos for the podcast launch on the Monday and Tuesday. That time I now do to cold outreach, I now do to sales, and I push messages out on social media. That's got me a very high ticket client, that time that I took. So just that realization that actually I pay £50. So let's say it's for 4 podcasts a month. That's £200 a month. But actually I just signed a client which is worth £1,000 a month.
Right.
Just by doing the cold outreach.
I'm right there. That's the answer. I used to always say, so say for example, your hourly rate is £80, whatever. I don't like hourly rates. Don't get me on the hourly rate, day rate soapbox. But you obviously have to have a rough idea of what your hourly rate is, because there are certain circumstances in which clients come back to me for extra amends, I have to charge an hourly rate. So if your hourly rate's £80 and you're paying someone £40, it's just a complete no-brainer. As soon as you can get into that headspace where, yes, you are going to provide someone else with those tasks, it just frees you up the headspace and the time to do more of that stuff that makes you twice as much money as you're paying.
Yeah, yeah. And then you're moving away, just to touch on another subject in your book, you're moving away from that dreaded burnout. Yeah. Because I've felt that creeping up, especially in the last 4 or 5 weeks. It's because you're managing so many tasks. I mean, before I started the business, I didn't have a business account. You then have to register at Companies House. You then have to make sure your accounts are done each month. You have to, all of these things that you go into business thinking, I'm just going to make some money. I'm going to charge somebody this, pay a little bit of tax here, and then just shuffle it away. But actually there's a shit ton. And then you start to realize you need to do this consistently and regularly. And I hate doing, like, I did expenses for work, and it normally takes me about 3 months to submit my credit card expenses. And they're supposed to be submitted every single month, because I just hate going through receipts and doing all that stuff. Mm. So actually doing that in my own business, I don't want to do it. It's just...
No. Well, we all know what are the tasks we hate, and that really those are the things that you just... that they're the first things that should go. Yeah. And once you've found the right person, I mean, sometimes it can take a bit of perseverance to find the right person to outsource to. But once you've found that person, it's like having this, as I say, it's like having a team of cheerleaders who are all rooting for your business and all empowering you to spend more time doing the thing that makes you money.
Yeah. So within your book, you also touch on, and you've touched on it in the conversation, about the mental health sort of, how it affects your work and how all of that type of stuff. Mm-hmm. But towards the end, you start talking about imposter syndrome. And I've talked about this before.
Yeah.
Do you suffer with imposter syndrome?
Yeah. Oh, hell yeah. Even now, 21 years later, I absolutely do. And the self-doubt thing, it just doesn't go away. And this is the weird thing. I've just finished having a spate of counselling, weekly therapy, for about the third or fourth time in my life. I find it really helpful. And every week I'd be saying to the guy, oh, I just need to reread chapter 8 again, don't I? All the advice, and I know what the coping strategies are and the things that you should and shouldn't do when you are feeling that. It's also very closely tied in with social media. I'm sure you find this as well. But I mean, I look at your social media, Matt, and you're absolutely smashing it. And I look at mine, I'm kind of like, yeah, my Instagram game's a bit lame at the moment.
But then I look at my Instagram and I compare it to accounts that I see that I think are smashing it. And I go, why can't I be like that? There's different levels. I mean, you're looking at mine and I'm looking at somebody else's, and somebody else, that other person who I'm admiring, will then, and it, I was affected by that on social media. I was like you, I'm very hyper driven. So when I started on my Instagram profile, which was in April, I thought to myself, I need to beat this person. And then suddenly I beat that person. And then I beat the next person. And then I beat the next person. And you know what? When I then beat like the fifth person in a row, I was just thinking, that's not a real target. So now I don't focus on the number of followers. I don't focus on who I've got to beat. I just focus on what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. And if I'm putting the stuff out there, my following just decides to grow, which is a nice side effect, which is what I'm trying to generate. I'm trying to generate an audience or a community around my business.
Yeah. It shouldn't be about the numbers, should it? It's as as somebody said the other day, I put a post out on LinkedIn about the importance of sharing a personalized message when you connect with people that you don't know. Why the heck should any of us accept a random connection request from a stranger? Whereas if they give a compelling reason, they've just listened to you on a podcast or they've just read your book or whatever, then I want to connect with that person. But if they don't send a personalized message, then I don't know any of that.
Exactly.
So I shared this post and it seemed to have really resonated with a lot of people. And someone said, after all, you're trying to build and nurture a network. You're not collecting Pokemon cards. And I thought, I love that.
Exactly.
It's like some people, it's just a numbers game and it shouldn't be like that.
Yeah. I mean, to touch on what you were just saying then, I very recently, so within the last 6 weeks, I've also finished a year, 14 months worth of weekly therapy just to deal with some of the issues that I've had. But one of those issues was, and it's again, the hyper-driven, very inclusive, very, I want to succeed for myself.
Yeah.
That's what I worked on for the last year. And now I look at the success I generate and I have an emotional attachment. And we touched on this in the last podcast with Danny Allen Page, but now I have an emotional attachment to the end goal. So that end goal has an emotional attachment. And that emotional attachment isn't my emotional attachment. It's what I want others to have. So for example, my main goal for 2021 is to get enough money so I can have a deposit for a house. Now that's a material attachment and that's a material goal. But the emotional attachment to that is that my wife and children will have a lovely home. Mm-hmm. So when I feel that emotion for somebody else, that's a way I can remain hyper-driven and committed to my goal, but mm-hmm. bring others into that as well. Because
I like that.
Yeah, it was a huge revelation for me because and this is going quite deep into the therapy, but with drug addicts, they find their island is their drug intake. With alcoholics, they find that alcohol is their intake. With me, because of my upbringing, and I'm not going to get into that now, but because of my upbringing, my safe space was actually just myself. So anytime that I felt under pressure.
You and me both, Matt. Virtual fist bump. Yeah, 100%.
Yeah. Mm. So my safe space was actually myself. So anytime I felt stressed or going into that fight or flight mode, actually, I'd just go in introspective and just look at myself and just sit in myself and be really selfish and just take care of myself, which is fine, but it's not if you're in a happy relationship and you want to move that stuff forward. So, yeah, big up to the therapy crew.
Yeah. Yeah. I love the fact that people are open to talking about that kind of thing now, because honestly, I swear even a couple of years back, people just weren't open about talking about mental health issues and the importance of positive mental health. And from the perspective of the self-employed community, it's we have to represent for ourselves and we have to prioritize our own mental health and well-being. If you're lucky enough to work for a large organization now, chances are you might have a designated mental health first aider or a representative or a pastoral person who you can go to if you're struggling with stress or overwhelm or mental health issues, anxiety, whatever. But we don't have that.
No.
If you don't prioritize your own mental health, nobody else is going to do that for you. So that's why there is a running theme throughout Survival Skills for Freelancers about the importance of boundaries and balance and avoiding burnout.
Because and taking care of yourself. So
taking care of yourself,
the self-care. To bring you back all the way to the start of the podcast, swimming, exercise,
absolutely,
and having that own headspace is exactly how you should be taking care of yourself. Because if you can't look after number one, then how can you perform best? It's like put oxygen mask on the plane first.
Yeah.
You
have nothing to give to your clients. You can't possibly be your best self as a working individual or as any sort of person if you're not taking care of yourself. You're not eating properly. You're not sleeping enough. You're not doing those little self-care things like day to day, we all sit in front of our laptops for hours on end, and we're kind of hunched over typing away, and we're completely absorbed in the world of work and the world of social media and this sort of thing. But it's vital to regularly get up away from your desk and stretch out. And, you know, even if you're just going downstairs, make yourself a drink, unload the dishwasher while you're doing it, just actually just get moving. And those breaks, particularly if you can get outside just for a quick bike ride, a run, or take the dog out for a walk, whatever, those are the times where you, it's almost like it resets your brain.
Yeah.
Because you're taking a proper break away from what you've been completely focused on, and it just frees up your mind to solve those problems, those tricky things that have been, you've been kind of stuck on when you're in the moment in front of your screen. Those problems just solve themselves when you're out. You get the endorphins release and those kind of feel-good hormones, the stress-relieving hormones circling through your body. And it just makes you more productive. So many people will kind of go, oh, I haven't got time to take time out during my day to go and exercise. But you have to make time because you're the only person who can do that.
Yeah. I mean, I've started a ritual in the last 2 or 3 weeks, and I now religiously, either before work or after work, I didn't this morning because it was absolutely hammering down with rain, but I now take the dogs for a walk as soon as I get home, because then it gives me time to get out, just have 10, 15 minutes to decompress after work.
Yes, decompress time, yeah.
Yes, because then all of the stuff that I have been thinking about and storing in my head, and that's another subject entirely about getting stuff out of your head and onto a piece of paper, but all of that stuff that I've stored in my head to remember through work, I can then add to my Notion board, because I work with an app which allows me to get all of that stuff into a list so that I can review it tomorrow. Ooh. But it also means that I can just rest, just that mental break of like 15, 20 minutes of walking, because we've only got Dashan, so they don't need a huge walk. But that 15, 20 minutes just gives me that time to just go,
yeah.
And that's all you need. That's all you need.
Yeah. And that, I would say that that's particularly important for anybody who's working from home at the moment, whether that's your norm or something that you're just doing right now while things are up in the air. It's important to have that kind of, like you say, decompression time. That's what I've always called it. It's just that kind of break between, okay, now I'm sitting in front of my laptop and I'm going to go downstairs and make dinner because it's the end of the day and I'm finishing. Yeah. If you can get out of the house, I heard a story once about somebody who was self-employed, who would go out of their front door and come back into their home through the back door. And that was how they knew that their working day had ended.
That's great.
I love that because it's super simple. I mean, I'd still recommend at least having a walk around the block before you go back in the back door. But anything that will kind of create a balance between work time and home time, and they are so closely linked now more so than ever. Just try to make sure that your working time doesn't absorb into your home time all the time, because it's so easy. You know, we're all connected through our phones. We're checking work emails on our phones in the evening, or like I said earlier on, touching on replying to LinkedIn messages. It's really easy for your relationships to be negatively impacted by those actions.
Yeah.
And you're the only person who can kind of set those boundaries and make sure that those things don't happen.
Yeah, definitely. Before we get on to the last five questions, which I know you've prepped for already, I've got this mental image now of that guy who goes out of his front door and coming in the back door shouting, "Hi, honey, I'm home," as soon as he walks through the back door. So we're coming up to the end of the podcast, Sarah, and what we do on every single episode is ask the same five questions.
Yes.
So I'm going to ask them to you. And the first question I'm going to ask is, what was the last book that you read?
I've actually got two answers, a fiction book and a non-fiction book. The fiction book is Sweet Sorrow by David Nichols, who writes about teenage angst better than anybody else I have ever come across. And I'm currently cherishing the last 40, 50 pages. I just don't want it to end. It's so, so good. In terms of a business book, I've got a feeling you've had this author on the show, Jules White.
Jules is actually the next episode, so that's a little bit of a spoiler.
Yeah. Amazing. Well, I appeared on her podcast and we chatted for the first time. We didn't know one another apart from through LinkedIn. We chatted like old friends. I just thought she was fantastic. We had so much in common. And after the podcast, she bought herself a copy of Survival Skills for Freelancers and I bought a copy of her book, Live It, Love It, Sell It.
Yeah.
And I loved it. It took me a while to read because I wanted to do it all properly and highlight it. And I've got pages dog-eared with the corners turned down and big scrawl bits everywhere. I just love her approach. She writes in a very human, very personal, warm, lovely way, which is quite similar to my own book. So I'd thoroughly recommend that.
See, that's what I'm struggling with as well, because for copywriters, it's like you said, when you work for other people, it's like an actor coming out and doing a different accent and then coming off stage and then continuing that accent for a little bit, just because they're living that role.
Yeah.
I want to write a book, but my personality in real life is quite jovial and it's quite funny and there's short quips, but I'm not sure how that would come across on paper. Does that make sense?
Yeah, because but I think you have to be true to that. Because I think the best books are the books that read like a conversation with the person who's written them.
Somebody does that.
That's the word I'm after.
Yeah, somebody does this very well. And I can imagine him speaking. I've got quite a few Russell Brand books on the back.
Behind me.
And when Russell Brand writes, you can tell, because Russell Brand's quite flamboyant and how he talks and he uses very large words, he does that throughout his book. So it's very much a conversation with Russell Brand when you're having a conversation with him.
Yeah.
And I want to do that, but I just want to make sure that the voice is right. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it totally does. But I don't think you can. I don't know. Maybe this is just because it's easy for me. Someone said to me, how did you take the decision for your book to be so personal and so authentic to you? And I kind of thought, is that a trick question? Because I don't know any other way to be. It would never occur to me to pretend to be something that I wasn't. And that's something that I really strongly advocate to all business owners, because people ultimately are buying into you as a business owner. And if they don't feel that genuine connection, if there's a disconnect between what you're putting out there on social media, and then they have a conversation with you and they're kind of like, wait, I don't recognize this person, you're creating an additional hurdle that they have to jump over before you actually secure them as a client. So I don't think you can be anything other than yourself. Let your own voice shine through, Matt.
What did you want to be when you grew up, Sarah?
Yeah, well, I kind of never really had this thing. I remember being like disappointed when the careers advisor at school said, oh, you should work in a bank or a building society. And I thought, God, that's dull ass. I kind of used to think that it was something to do with design of some sort. I used to have all these little notebooks that I used to do. It was really cringe. I used to draw all these little outfits, do like fashion design kind of thing, and give them really cheesy names like Rayon Rainbow. And
my daughter's going through this stage. Satin
Sunshine.
So we had this conversation this weekend, and she's got two imaginary friends, which she designs dresses for. So she's got Tiger Lily. Oh. And then Rosie May. But she's now designing dresses, and she's 11. I mean, it's not like the early 5-year-old stage where they always have imaginary friends. It's that she's proper into drawing the dresses and fashion design and all that type of stuff. So it's just about harnessing that, isn't it?
Yeah, well, unfortunately for me, I'm absolutely shit at drawing. so I don't think a career in fashion design was really ever likely to go anywhere for me. But I always said if I wasn't a copywriter, I'd like to do interior design. Because people always say, oh, I love your homes, like the colours and I'm really obsessive about colour, though. It's another thing. Like, I can't have this room's kind of all you can see all yellow and but it's not bright yellow, it's like dirty yellow,
mustard kind of yellow.
It's really nice, but all of my rooms are so color themed. Like, I can't have something out of place. Got no blue in my house anywhere. Like, nothing blue is allowed.
You couldn't have a green cushion.
It is really obsessive.
Is that a green cushion behind you?
It's not a green cushion, it's the same
yellow color.
See, this is like the perfect match, Matt. Look,
it's like the black and yellow dress debate, isn't it? Because I could see that and it looked green.
Oh, okay, that's interesting. Yeah, I remember the black and yellow dress. Yeah, so interior designer, I don't know.
What was the next question? Who is the leader that you look up to the most?
It has to be a woman. And I was really sort of struggling with this question. And then I, because I don't really do politics, but I have to say it has to be Jacinda Ardern.
Yeah, that's been... Right? Yeah,
she's just, I don't follow politics a lot, as I say, but everything I've heard about her, I just wish he was our prime minister. I wish we had a strong leader like that. She just seems incredible.
Can I ask why the decision had to be a woman?
Oh, just, girl power. I look at so many podcasts and things that I've been on and I kind of think, so many times, I mean, particularly when it's a guy doing the interview, I've noticed that there's a real imbalance of male to female guests. I can't say that for yours. I'm sure you're perfectly balanced. But
I'm not. And I had two female guests on my first season and it was 15 episodes. And I'll have two female guests on this season. Oh, it's not a...
Out of how many?
Out of 15. So it's not a conscious decision to exclude females from the podcast, but I think it's because of the industry, sales, and this is why I was really keen to get Jules on the podcast, actually, because sales and the corporate world, and it's predominantly male led, and males want to shout and like be the silverback gorilla and come on podcasts and stuff. I mean, it's not because I'm excluding females. I'm really not. I want as many females on the podcast as I have males.
Perhaps you don't get as many offers from women who want to guest.
Yeah. I'm open to any female guest coming on the podcast. It's very difficult to say this as a white male, but I don't want to exclude that. But I'm not actively excluding it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I actually kind of feel like I'm on a bit of a mission to redress the balance with a few podcasts and panels and that kind of thing, and doing talks and the like and live interviews. But I, when I was writing Survival Skills, one of the people who I didn't find it very easy to find information about how to self-publish on Amazon, and I came across two guys. American podcasters, YouTubers, sorry. And one of them, a guy called Dale, oh, Mandelblock. I just call him self-published with Dale. I can't for the life of me think of his surname. So I was obsessively watching this guy's videos and learning everything I possibly could from him. And then it occurred to me that occasionally he gets guests on and they're always guys. And I thought, do you know what? He's just a person, ultimately. Yeah, okay, he's got however many hundreds of thousands of followers. I'll just connect with him on LinkedIn, drop him a message and just say, look, I'm quite active in his sort of community. I'll comment on his videos. So he sort of probably knew my name through that. But I messaged him and said, look, I would love to chat on, I'd love to do a video blog with you. How about getting me on as a guest? And we chatted the other day and it was so surreal because I'm used to seeing him on my screen doing the videos. He's got the same background when you Zoom call him. And he's like, yes, definitely. He said he's doing a quick release of three very short books about keywords and this sort of thing about publishing on Amazon. And he said, as soon as that's over, start of November, hit me up again and we'll get a date in and I'm going to be on his show. And it was only through asking. So I don't have any problem pushing myself forward. And I don't know where that's come from, but I mean, certainly when I was brought up, it was always like, don't be pushy. Don't try to get attention and that kind of thing. So I've always struggled with that. That was kind of one of the therapy things for me, because I feel like I don't want to be pushy about myself, but obviously I want to help as many people. I've put this book together. It's had 170 odd reviews in 4 months and 95% of them are five star. I want to spread the word as far as I possibly can. There's no point in my brain. There's no point doing something if you're going to half-ass it.
Yeah.
What's the point of even doing it? So it's just natural to me that I'm going to want to try and get as many opportunities for the book, not for me. I don't know. I see that as a difference.
It's very, And to flip it the other way. No, to flip it the other way, we had a guest on the podcast, Paul Kincaid, who's former lieutenant colonel in the army. Very, like, yeah, he's quite a man of stature, but he finds it very difficult to self-promote because of the army and because of that he went through the Sandhurst process and he was an officer in the British Army. It's frowned upon in order to like big yourself up and say, look what I can do.
Right.
So to flip it the other way, there are men out there who that think that self-promotion and publicizing themselves is the wrong thing to do. But we came to the agreement that confidence and arrogance are two different things.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah.
So much that, yeah.
I've forgotten the other two questions. I want to leave the selling one to the end to give you a bit of... What's the other question that I was to
ask? The worst job you could ever do. Oh, I struggled with that. I mean, I've been vegetarian since I was 10, so I guess like going rural specific, I guess it would be working in one of those... I can't even remember the name. A meat place. What do you call them? I'm not talking about a butcher. I mean, an abattoir, that's it. Yeah, so rural specifics, it would be working in an abattoir. But I honestly think after 20 plus years of self-employment, it would now be anything that involves having a boss. I think I've kind of become unemployable. I just don't like being told what to do by other people, which is why whenever I'm setting up a relationship with a client or choosing whether or not to work with a new client, I want to really stress to them that I want to work in partnership with them. I don't want them to be kind of being the boss, telling me as a supplier what to do. It's never worked that way for me for many years. And I just think you get the best out of a relationship when you really have a full understanding of the client's goals and where they are, where they want to be. It's not just, oh, can you write me a 2,000 word brochure? It's not really about what I do. It's about
why.
Having that full understanding, because I have a commercial marketing background, a lot of copywriters are ex-journalists, and that's a completely different style of writing. It's a different skill altogether. But having had that commercial background, I really understand the goals and the drivers and the outcomes and this sort of thing needed from the copywriting process. It's not just, hey, write me 1,000 words. Okay, here are 1,000 words. It's like, but why are you doing it that way? Have you thought about doing it this way? What about trying this? I'm quite a challenger, naturally.
Yeah, yeah. And the final question, what's the worst sales mistake that you've ever made?
Yeah, I've really struggled with this question, Matt. I found this really difficult. I don't see myself as doing sales, which obviously that's ridiculous because I kind of do. I think probably like turning the clock back many years, thinking of sales being a dirty word, like, oh God, you know, sales is pushy. It's targets and trying to make someone buy something that they don't actually want. It's all those negative assumptions around the process of selling. And as soon as I realized that for me, the process of selling was about building and nurturing relationships. And as soon as I understood the know, like, and trust, and the fact that they're not necessarily wanting to work with somebody who's super slick and the processes are all there and it's like a well-oiled machine. Hey, my clients want the process
they want
of
the
working.
Quirks.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. Thank God they do want the quirks because I've got them in bucket loads. It's to do with wanting the experience to be enjoyable and pleasant and easy and fun.
Yeah.
It's just kind of making all those assumptions. I'm sorry, I don't have a really great. Oh, I
no,
really
that's a great
that
answer.
Story, but
no, that's a great answer. Where can people find more information about you, Sarah?
I would say the easiest way to find all my contact details is to go to survivalskillsforfreelancers.com. That's got a direct link to read more about the book on Amazon. It's got a link to my copywriting website. It's got all my social media links and my email address.
Perfect. Thank you for your time this morning.
Pleasure.